From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Shakespeare in Love, the romantic comedy about a young Will Shakespeare with writer's block, is up for 13 Academy Awards, including one for Best Original Screenplay. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with the screenwriters Mark Norman and Tom Stoppard. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Heart and Sack by the Pandellas Karyorgis Trio, three players with an eccentric approach to rhythm. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Yesterday, the film Shakespeare in Love added 15 British Academy Award nominations to its 13 Oscar nominations in the U.S. One of the categories it's nominated for here is Best Original Screenplay. My guests are the authors of the screenplay, Mark Norman and Tom Stoppard. Stoppard also wrote about Shakespeare in his first staged play, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead. Shakespeare in Love is a romantic comedy set in the 1590s. The young William Shakespeare is having trouble writing his latest play, Romeo and Ethel, the Pirate's Daughter, until he finds his muse, a beautiful woman who has disguised herself as a man in order to act in Shakespeare's play. The play is to be performed at the Rose Theatre, and the theatre's owner, Philip Henslowe, is in debt to an unscrupulous moneylender named Fenneman. In this scene, the moneylender and one of his henchmen are dragging away the frightened theater owner, played by Geoffrey Rush.
What have I done, Mr. Fenneman?
The theaters have all been closed down by the plague.
Oh, that.
By order of the master of the revels.
Mr. Fenneman, allow me to explain about the theater business. The natural condition is one of insurmountable obstacles on the road to imminent disaster. Believe me, to be closed by the plague is a bagatelle in the ups and downs of owning a theater.
So what do we do?
Nothing. Strangely enough, it all turns out well.
How?
I don't know. It's a mystery.
Shall I kill him, Mr. Fenneman?
The theatres are reopened by order of the Master of the Revels.
Mr. Fenneman. Mr. Tilney has reopened the playhouses.
Yes, I heard.
Mark Norman, let me start with you. You originated the screenplay. Tell us the origin of the idea.
Well, I'm proud to say, I love to tell this story, that I got the idea from one of my kids. I have two sons. They're both, they're twins. They're now almost 30. They grew up in the house of a freelance writer. They figured out very early it'd be a good idea for them to come up with ideas for their dad. When they were young, they kind of had kid ideas, but they got more sophisticated as they got older. And Zach was taking an Elizabethan theater course at Boston University and gave me a call from a phone booth one day and said, here it is, Shakespeare starting out in the Elizabethan theater business. And I said, that's brilliant, because I really thought it was. It was kind of the combination of imagination and obscurity that kind of appeals to me in an idea. And I told him I really didn't know what to do with it. And I didn't for about 3 years, and I came up with lots of lousy ideas to kind of expand that notion. And I kept on throwing them away because I didn't want to just add to the sort of pile of junk that's around Shakespeare in terms of the fiction. I wanted something that I thought was good. And one day I realized I'd been looking at it all along and missing it, and what that was Shakespeare as a professional writer. Shakespeare as, I wouldn't say a screenwriter, but Shakespeare as a professional writer in a capitalistic entertainment business. Nobody, as far as I could tell, had ever really looked at him quite that way before. And that was kind of the beginning.
How have you rewarded your son for this idea?
With a check. I mean, we're all in this business, and, you know, money is the Esperanto of show business. Everybody understands that language. And that's what he wanted, and that's what he deserved. And he was happy with it.
Did you give him a share, or how did you come up with how much to give him?
Well, I came up with a figure that I thought would please him, and it did. Let's leave it at that.
Okay. Now, Tom Stoppard, where do you enter the story?
Well, I enter the story because Mark's foundational screenplay, original screenplay by Mark Norman, Shakespeare in Love, arrived on my desk one day because I don't know what happened in between, but at some point, Universal got your screenplay, Mark, didn't they?
That's right.
And I think Universal had one or two actors interested, and they wanted to take it further. And perhaps, though I never asked them, they perhaps thought, quite apart from the usual Hollywood law, you know, one writer good, two writers better, three writers maybe best, etc. I think that perhaps they thought some English input as well. I don't know. But I read it, and I responded much as Mark did to his son. I thought, this is a good idea.
So, Tom Stoppard, what did you add to or change about the screenplay?
Well, this the the story, if one, you know, said it in a paragraph, is really very much as it was, isn't it, Mark? I was actually in a position which I find a happy position, and I've always felt the same way about the relatively few films I've done. I've always worked from either a novel or, in two cases, an original screenplay which came my way. And I always felt that meant that somebody else had done the hard part, and I was there to do the part which I really loved doing, which was dialogue, and which really came much more easily to me than inventing stories. So Shakespeare in Love was really the best example of that happy situation for me. And if you're looking for exactitude and everything in a nutshell, I think I'm right in saying that the dialogue itself is by William Shakespeare and by me pretty much, and the actual structure of what happens is what I inherited.
Now, one of the premises of Shakespeare in Love is that Shakespeare has a writing block. Did he ever, do you know?
I don't even think it's a writing block. I mean, I know people are saying that, but for me, it's not a writing block. And I really don't believe there is such a thing as writing block. I think what Shakespeare's problem is that he wants to write something better than he has before, and he doesn't know how to get there. That's not exactly a block. He could write Romeo and Ethel, the pirate's daughter, if somebody put a gun to his head. He just doesn't want to. He doesn't want to take the time. He knows he could do better, but he doesn't know how to get there. And that's, I think, his problem. Historically, did he have a writer's block? I can't imagine Shakespeare ever having any kind of block. He was a machine of playwriting, as far as I can tell.
To write anything at all, you have to really have a sort of inner enthusiasm and desire, appetite, to do it. And it's that enthusiasm, that appetite, which in turn, depends on your own need to go further, do better. I think that if you're into, you know, pot boiling, just sort of run-of-the-mill recycling, that's when you can't raise the energy just to, you know, get going at all.
Right.
But when you are struck by a notion which, you know, captures your imagination and you catch fire a little bit, then you don't have that huge impediment towards doing it. And people think that writer's block is somebody who's desperately keen to write something but doesn't quite know what to do next. I don't feel it like that.
My favorite quote about screenwriting comes from Christopher Isherwood, who said, a screenwriter is a man who's being tortured to confess, who has nothing to confess. What I take that to mean is the hardest thing for a screenwriter, a professional writer to do is come up with passion for his job. There's a job that has to be done. Where is he going to get the passion from? Where is he going to get something to confess? Shakespeare wants to write about love and doesn't know anything about love. He, like most young poets, is better at words than meaning. And he needs the meaning. He's got the words. But he knows the words are empty without some kind of emotion behind them, and that's hopefully what the picture is about.
Yeah, nice point. You know, he sets out to write Romeo and Ethel, which of course sounds very funny to our ears because we know of Romeo and Juliet, and there's something so mundane sounding about the name Ethel. Did you go through a lot of names? Did you try Romeo and Janice and Romeo and Lucy and Romeo and Linda before saying Romeo and Ethel, that's the ticket?
Yeah, it was just a stroke of genius.
To me, Shakespeare in Love is, in a way, a spoofing of a kind of Hollywood biopic, particularly of the songwriter type of mm-hmm. biography story, where, say, the songwriter is crossing the street and they hear a car horn honk, and suddenly that honking car horn becomes transformed in their mind into
right.
a
I
song.
Must capture that sound.
Yeah, and it becomes like their most famous song and everything. Yeah. And this seems to be, in a way, a spoof of that type of Hollywood approach to biography.
I think ours is more accurate.
That's right.
Well, certainly. I mean, I did a fair amount of research before I started writing, and one of the wonderful things I found going into the history of the Elizabethan theater was that it was show business. I mean, it's not what we think of as kind of this this rustic, cute masterpiece theater kind of industry. It was show business. They invented it. Everything we think of show business in terms of kind of its cliches, the star system, contracts, backstabbing, rivalries, all that they invented. They had it, and in a really remarkable short amount of time. I mean, the first theater dedicated to putting on plays was in London 10 years before Romeo and Juliet.
Did you do a lot of research into the Elizabethan theaters? You have two competing theater owners in Shakespeare in Love.
Well, there was a stroke of luck, wasn't there? Because around about the time, this time, the archaeological remains of the Rose Theatre were accidentally discovered by some people who were building an office block south of the Thames. And, you know, I live just upstream. And as a result of that discovery, one or two books were published. There was one particularly illuminating one. So there was suddenly some available material which was really specific to the setting of Mark's story.
How did the theaters compete back then, do you know?
Well, they competed the way studios compete now. I mean, people have a certain amount of money that they're willing to spend on entertainment. And which theater are they going to go to? Which movie are they going to go to? The one with stars. The Elizabethans figured out that if you had a star in your company, people would come to that play. Do you have lots of sword fights and lots of excitement? People will come to that play. The basis of competition was the same then as it is now.
I understand that some of the theaters during the time of Shakespeare were closed on account of the plague, because people would catch it from each other if they're in...
And there was actually a real plague in the year in which our story is set. And I mean, you're quite right. They were periodically closed for all kinds of reasons, and that was one of them.
But more than that, the city of London, the city fathers, hated plays and were always looking for an excuse to shut them down. They felt that they were lewd. They felt that they drew the young apprentices away from their work, that work didn't get done because they were going to plays in the afternoon. And they were always looking for reasons to shut the plays down. And really, the only reason the playhouses survived was because of Elizabeth. Elizabeth liked plays. And the company, there was a sort of a legal fiction in those days that the companies had to perform plays to rehearse their actors so when they went to command performances for Elizabeth, they'd be good. They'd do well.
What's interesting is that even now, right up to now, the profession of actor trails little wisps of rather kind of romantic outsiderness. They are outsiders and so on. And that comes right from where this movie lives, the actor as vagabond. Mm-hmm. Theaters were inn yards. I mean, I think Mark just made that point, that the first purpose-built theater in London was you know, extraordinarily late. I guess it was in the 1570s, Mark?
84.
Oh, well done. Yeah. Really. So up to then, you know, we're talking about people. You couldn't even call it being on tour. They trailed around. They set up shop wherever they could. And I think that the notion of actors and theatre folk in general being riffraff survived right into 20th century romantic fiction and trails itself to this very day. There are people who would not like their daughter to marry an actor. And the whole notion of chorus girls marrying dukes, it is all that.
My guests are Tom Stoppard and Mark Norman. Their screenplay, Shakespeare in Love, is nominated for an Academy Award. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. The movie Shakespeare in Love is nominated for 13 Oscars. My guests are the screenwriters Mark Norman and Tom Stoppard. I wonder if while writing Shakespeare in Love, you were thinking about what it might have been like for you if you were writing for audiences in Elizabethan times.
Well, I'll tell you a little story about that. In the course of the research, I found a lawsuit between a theater company and a writer. This was about 20 years after Romeo and Juliet. By then, the business had gotten... It was such a big business that companies had to have writers under contract exclusive to them. And the lawsuit was about the fact that the writer had been paid in advance for 3 plays in a year, and he hadn't turned them in, and the company wanted their money back. And the writer's defense was, well, there was a plague, and I couldn't work. And the theater company said, oh, come on, you know, plague isn't going to stop you from writing. So they went to trial, and I think they settled it. But what was interesting was that his contract was appended to the trial transcript. And what it said was that this writer was exclusive to this company. He had to write 3 plays in a year. He had to be available to do rewrites on other plays the company owned. He had to be able to do prologues and epilogues on other plays that the company owned. He had to be available to do jokes and songs and additional material on other plays the company owned. And I showed this to my wife, and I said, I signed this contract with Disney last year. They invented the contracts.
Oh, that's funny. What about the audiences? Do you think that they were probably responsive? How sophisticated do you think they were? Could you have done a lot of in-jokes and be confident that the audience would get it? Did they have art houses?
It's almost mystifying, isn't it, that, as it were, in one jump, you got into a kind of theater which is extraordinarily complex. It has quite broad humor. I mean, very broad humor in some cases, combined with the highest poetry, very literary theater. And as far as one can judge, it had overall popularity. Not every play did, of course, but there was a need for the theaters which were being built, and there were 2 or 3 theaters built within a short space of time, and they could contain quite large audiences. I mean, when you think how small London was, these were large arenas, and it's rather. I said it was mysterious, but it's also rather wonderful that the language of the Elizabethan theatre did bind together the groundlings and the rich people in the boxes and the actors on stage.
And that concept really influenced both of us in writing the screenplay, because we couldn't sort of be less than Shakespearean. Shakespeare was obviously writing for the entire spectrum of his audience, and the movie could do no less. The movie had to have high poetry. It had to have dogs and sword fights and pie fights. I think of my take on Shakespeare is a very shrewd entertainment entrepreneur who knows his audience specifically, knows exactly what they want, knows exactly how to give it to them, and does it over and over again with a sort of an astounding ability.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Mark Norman and Tom Stoppard, the authors of the screenplay for the movie Shakespeare in Love, nominated for lots of Academy Awards. Now, you had to, in Shakespeare in Love, mix Elizabethan language and contemporary language, Elizabethan ideas and contemporary ideas, because the movie's really a wedding of the two. Did you come up with certain almost ground rules to guide what was okay and what was out of bounds in terms of the writing for the movie?
Speaking for myself, I never work from rules like that. The problem...
What I mean by rules is that sometimes a movie or a play will have its own inner reality, and you have to set the terms of what that reality is.
No, I understood that, but somehow the process is much more instinctual. Which word do I mean? You'll tell me sometime. And I think that the problem always seems to be much more local. What should the next line sound like? And it's only when you look back that you think, oh, I see, there's a kind of pattern here. There's a private language and a public language. But you're working on your nerve ends, really, because some of the remarks made in the film have no business to exist in 1590, whatever. They simply shouldn't exist. And yet there's no sense of dislocation. And I think that, as Marx said, you know, one is trying to bind everything together in a particular spirit, which includes high poetry and low humor.
Mark, anything you want to add about that just, and the inner reality?
What I found, and the question you asked was about the dialogue.
Yeah.
What I found that it really was a question of sort of taking Elizabethan cadences, kind of the rhythm of the speech, but not sticking with Elizabethan words, because so many of those words are archaic, and we weren't out to do masterpiece theater. We weren't out to do something that was a challenge for people to understand. As a matter of fact, from the beginning, I wanted this to be a very commercial picture. I wanted this to play in malls. I didn't want this to play in an art house. And so it was a question of finding a language that smelled Elizabethan but worked perfectly well for a contemporary audience.
Want to give me an example of a line that you think fits that description?
Nothing comes to mind.
Tom Stoppard, want to give it a shot?
No, actually, I'm really thinking of a line, Marco, which, to my grief, which I feel to this day, someone never made it into final cut, because it's exactly the center of the Broadway writer's experience, where everybody's gathering to watch Romeo and Juliet, and a man we've never seen or met before says to his neighbor in the audience, "I hear they had trouble with this play." And I suppose Madden probably thought that this was a very esoteric in-joke for Mark and for people like me. But in fact, you laughed. And to me, that was the quintessential Broadway moment.
Tom Stoppard and Mark Norman wrote the screenplay Shakespeare in Love. They'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. By the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And Pantheon Books, publisher of Anne Lamott's latest book, Traveling Mercies, Some Thoughts on Faith, available in bookstores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with Mark Norman and Tom Stoppard about writing Shakespeare in Love. And Kevin Whitehead reviews a new release by the Pandelis Choreorgas Trio, three guys with quirky timing. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Mark Norman and Tom Stoppard. Their screenplay, Shakespeare in Love, is nominated for an Academy Award. The movie has a total of 13 Oscar nominations. This romantic comedy is not only about love, it's about the ups and downs of the theater world in the 1590s. I think one thing that Shakespeare in Love is actually pretty serious about is the transformative power of good theater, transformative both for the performers and for the audience. You think?
Well, we like to think so, yes.
Yeah, I think
And I mean, one of the nice things about the film is that it does a tremendous job on behalf of the theatre. I'm almost surprised by it. It came up and surprised me. But people know less about how theatre is put on than one imagines they do, or perhaps they just never think about it at all. And you know, you walk into a theatre, and most people have had that experience. You're not looking for transformative power to descend upon you. And at the same time, you know, you're aware that theatre is a very pragmatic art form. It's got these physical limits, what you can do, what you can't do, how big the stage is, what you can see, what you can't see, what you can hear, what you can't hear. It's a severely constrained art form. And because of the constraints, under pressure, the people who are truly creative in theatre can transcend these bounds. And that's when an audience feels similarly transformed. And I think that the way the film shows a play when it's in pieces and when it's somehow a practical problem, and the way that that transmutes and develops into something which takes you out of yourself, where you completely believe in a pair of lovers, all that. I think that, this isn't a brag, it's an observation. I can't remember a movie which quite did that before. And I think that's one of the reasons that the film has struck something of a chord.
I agree with Tom, and I would say in some ways it's a tribute to our director, John Madden, because he had to show that on film. I mean, we had the idea in the script, but he had to show it on film, and I think he does a superb job of that. The way I see it happening is that three-quarters of the film, we in the audience are pretty much watching the backstage story. But at the end of the picture, when the show's about to go up and the Londoners are filing into the theater, I think somehow we shift our allegiance to them. We kind of join them as spectators and sit in the audience of The Rose and wonder how this thing is going to come out. And I think part of our pleasure is, I think we share the pleasure of the audience, that we've seen something remarkable happen before our eyes. That's kind of what the picture's about. We've seen it happen before our eyes. And Tom and I have both had the experience of working on shows that seem absolute disasters, and the curtain goes up, and somehow people transcend themselves. Somehow people get their act together and do things that you never expected. It is part of the transformative magic of theater, and it happens for the performers, and it happens for the audience as well.
There is a long line of American film which concerns itself with the making of a musical.
Oh, the backstage musical, the Busby Berkeley movie. Films, yeah.
And I think that that's you know, we're in similar territory there.
Mm-hmm.
But the emphasis is much more on the joy of song and dance, I mean, especially dance. And I think that because Romeo and Juliet, and indeed Shakespeare in Love, simply are the spoken word, it perhaps concentrates the sense of that process. That's an almost unintelligible statement. Is it noon yet? Something must account for
no,
my
I got what you're saying. Absolutely.
You're so kind.
No, that instead of like the Corinne who wants to become the star and it's about singing and dancing, this is a backstage thing about language.
Yeah. I think there's kind of a secret agenda about the movie. I mean, obviously it's about the theater. Obviously it's about writing. I think the secret agenda is it's about creativity and how it happens and how mortals like Shakespeare turn out things of genius. And I think that's kind of compelling for an audience. I think we haven't seen many movies about that.
Mm-hmm. My guests are Mark Norman and Tom Stoppard, who wrote the screenplay for Shakespeare in Love. Now, Mark Norman, when you had this idea for Shakespeare in Love, did you have a hard time convincing producers that there was money to be made here?
Of course. I mean, do you have to ask? We went to Universal Pictures because we had a relationship with Universal Pictures, and this was at a point where I had no idea what the story would be, and I had to go in and pitch something, and I am proud to say it was my best tap dance. Screenwriters all know this phrase called tap dancing. It's when you go in and try and get a job for something you have no idea how you're going to complete. And to my credit, I did a great tap dance. And to their credit, they bought it and said, okay, we'll take a shot on this. And I have to give credit to Universal. They're the ones who allowed it to happen.
What was your tap dance?
Oh, okay, I'll try to remember it. It was you're 24 years old. You're married to a woman 3 years older than you. You have a couple of kids. You had to marry her because you got her pregnant. You're working for your dad in a business you hate. You live in a little country town. It's boring. You go one night with all your relatives to a theater to see a show that's coming through town in a company that's passing through town. And they put on a show, and you're sitting in the audience, and you're looking at the show, and you think, I should be doing that. And the next day when the company leaves, you go with them. And the town is Stratford-on-Avon. It's Shakespeare, and it's 1584. And they said, okay.
Well, actually, that's a good, that's a nice happy ending to your tap dance. A friend of mine who was pitching a movie pitched this really wonderful romantic story about twins and exchanges of identity, and it was a tremendous pitch, and they all got very excited. And then his punchline was that it was Twelfth Night by William Shakespeare he wanted to shoot. And they got very unexcited.
Well, you know, after you did this pitch and they bought it, what happened when you went back later and said, well, it's actually going to start where I said it was going to end, and the focus of the story is going to be quite different from what I told you?
I never had any problem with that. They liked the script. They mm-hmm. saw how it... They probably knew I was tap dancing, and they probably figured, well, you know, we got some extra money. Let's take a shot on this guy.
Now, in Philadelphia, anyway, Shakespeare in Love started in the Art House, and I think it's now playing in cineplexes and malls as well.
I'm glad to hear that.
I know it started in the Art House. I think it's spreading beyond that in parts of the country, or am I wrong?
I think you're right. It's getting into wider and wider release, and I'm really happy to hear that because, as I said earlier, I never intended it to be an Art House movie.
Uh-huh.
Shakespeare wouldn't have written a play for an Art House audience. There wouldn't have been enough money in it. He wouldn't have limited his audience.
Was there a moment when you knew it was crossing over from just kind of art house success to a wider popular success?
No. I'm really surprised. I don't know what Tom would say, but I'm very surprised at the success of it. I had one clue that it worked as a picture. It worked on its own terms. When last year we started previewing it with audiences in New York, recruited audiences, and they seemed to get it. The feeling I had when the lights went up was that the audiences had gotten what the picture was trying to do. How that translated into box office success, we couldn't say. There's no correlation.
That's right. I have little experience. I didn't go to the previews, but when a friend of one of my sons showed up one day and said that his friend, who was an ex-boxer, had loved Shakespeare in Love, I thought, oh, we've cracked it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, Mark Norman, when you were trying to get Shakespeare in Love off the ground, and you were known in part as the author of the screenplay of Waterworld, which was a really expensive flop, did that stand in your way?
First of all, let me correct it. I did an uncredited rewrite on Waterworld. The credits are wrong, and I won't. This is not the quibble, but just to say that I'm not totally responsible for Waterworld.
Right. No. So you were one of the doctors who were supposed to save them.
Yeah.
Movie.
Yeah.
Right.
I was one of the doctors that couldn't save the patient. And interestingly enough, in this town, by this town I mean Hollywood, L.A., having a writing credit on a movie that doesn't do well or even is a colossal flop isn't particularly a problem because the industry knows that flops happen. Flops happen to the best of people and that there's no particular reason behind it, and that probably the guy who went in to do the last rewrite was under a lot of pressure, and it's really not his fault. So no, it's not particularly a handicap. It is at large. I mean, I've gotten a certain amount of kind of kicks in the shin from reviewers who said Shakespeare in Love from the putative writer of Waterworld. They're not quite familiar with how the business works.
In any event, Waterworld, in the end, wasn't exact. I wouldn't call it a flop. It actually did okay. Finally, it
got good for you, Tom.
It got beaten up by the critics. Of course, that's what you mean.
Yes, but it was savaged by the critics and actually made some money. Not to say that gives it merit.
No, we're not saying it gives it merit. But you know, there are flops and flops.
Right, Mark Norman. I have what might be a difficult question for you to respond to now. But I'm wondering if you felt at all slighted when it was suggested, well, this is swell, but let's bring in Tom Stoppard to work on it too.
Quite the opposite. When I heard that Tom was interested in working on the script, I thought, well, you know, what's the appropriate response when the foremost playwright in English language wants to work on your screenplay? The appropriate response is, sure. I was very delighted, and I was very delighted by what he did to the script and what he added to it. He did things that never would have occurred to me.
Name one.
Marlowe. Marlowe's a good example. I was terrified of Marlowe. The more I learned about Marlowe, the more I thought Marlowe was like kudzu, like crabgrass. If Marlowe got in the script, he'd take it over. It would wind up being Marlowe in Love because he's such a sort of volcanic personality. Tom rightly said, no, Marlowe belongs in it, and put him in.
And Tom Stoppard, why did you want Marlowe in there? And explain who Marlowe is.
Well, Christopher Marlowe was another playwright, of course, but he was from a very different background. He was one of the university wits. And there was a certain amount of snobbishness between the educated playwrights and the ones who, you know, were a bit down at heel and perhaps came from not the street as we understand it, but you know what I mean. And Marlowe was a successful playwright, and of course he's a great writer in his own right. But as it happens, he died young, and he was murdered, or he was stabbed to death in a tavern down a river in London. And in some way, it's as it happened actually in the very year in which Mark had set the story, it seemed that one should try to wrap it in somehow and hope that he didn't take over the movie. And it worked out quite interestingly, because one got a plot where Shakespeare, for a while, thinks that he's responsible for Marlowe's death. So that's who Marlowe is. But the whole thing of collaboration and the different forms of collaboration in the movie business, sometimes they're sequential, as in this case, where one writer follows another writer. I think it is an odd business. Perhaps we're all the victims of our own traditions. But it would be very odd in the theatre, and I've, over the years, found it less and less odd in the movies. I've got used to it, I could say. But I remember there's a movie script of mine, and you know what they always say about me? I mean, they've been saying it since, at a rough guess, 1964, that I'm really rather cold and dry, or I'm capable of I don't put enough juice and heat and warmth into these sexy, loving relationships, which are supposed to be in these movie scripts. And, you know, they sort of think, oh, well, Tom can do this, and then we'll get so-and-so who can do that, and she or he can mess around with Tom's script. And for that reason, I've never felt proprietorial about movie work in the same sense that I do feel it about my theater work.
My guests are Tom Stoppard and Mark Norman. Their screenplay, Shakespeare in Love, is nominated for an Academy Award. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are Tom Stoppard and Mark Norman, authors of the screenplay for Shakespeare in Love. I'd like for you to share some early Shakespeare memories with us, back from your maybe high school days when you first started to read Shakespeare.
My memories are those of dozing. I think, like most of the world, I dozed through Shakespeare.
Because I was a teenager and some adult was telling me, this is a demigod of the English language, you better appreciate him. And there was no proof. I was reading a text of a play, I don't know, it was probably Julius Caesar or something, and it was in a language I didn't understand, it was in a style I didn't understand, it was not performed, it was on paper, in a way Shakespeare never would have intended anybody to receive the play, and I just didn't get it. And it really took me a while to begin to appreciate Shakespeare. Well, first of all, I had to see some plays. Once I started seeing performances, it began to make sense. And then the more I became a professional writer, the more I understood the size of his achievement in terms of being a professional writer and doing what he did.
I got taken to see Laurence Olivier's Hamlet when I was at school. You know, a bunch of schoolboys taken to the local cinema. And I found it pretty boring. The next Hamlet, I mean, I was about 12 then, I would say, and I didn't see a Hamlet again for, 8 years. And it happened to be Peter O'Toole's Hamlet, not the one he did at the National Theatre later, but when he had just left drama school, he came to the Bristol Old Vic, where I was working on the local paper, and I saw his Hamlet. And that completely and utterly transformed my sense of what Hamlet was and what Shakespeare was. And then at other times, I mean, in the same period of my life, you know, the first time I saw that, it may have been Comedy of Errors, the idea that Shakespeare, that you didn't have to apologize for Shakespeare, that a Shakespearean comedy could make you laugh if it were done well, could make you laugh as much as any contemporary comedian can make you laugh, that was a revelation to me. I'm ashamed at how late I had that revelation, but my experience is similar to Mark's. You start off somehow intimidated, and perhaps the people who are introducing you to not just Shakespeare but any great writing, but perhaps they're doing it in the wrong way at the wrong time, or perhaps your head's in the wrong place. It very often goes wrong for a while, and then it comes right.
I think the way Shakespeare was presented to me is the bust of Shakespeare, the man who kind of stops below the collarbone, the man who's on the pedestal. And being kind of a goaty teenager, I pushed back. I resisted that. The idea behind the movie was to knock that bust off the pedestal and into the dirt and kick him around for a little while. But then at the end, restore him back to the pedestal with maybe a little better idea of why he belonged there. That was kind of one of the intentions behind the film.
Go ahead. No, I was going to ask Mark a question, rhetorical almost. I was going to say, how could he resist not saying at that moment that it was also the impulse to show what was below the collarbone and indeed below the waist?
Well, this is this is a public supported, this is government supported radio, right? I
mean, family
affair.
Okay,
yes,
right.
They all live below the waist too.
Well, no, but Tom's point is well taken. I mean, the notion of showing a Shakespeare that begins from the collarbone and goes down to the feet is kind of novel.
Tom Stoppard, I'm wondering, what about the Peter O'Toole Hamlet transformed your idea of Shakespeare?
Its energy, its clarity, the fact that it was a story with its own momentum and denouement, the performance itself, which I found enormously exciting, and the sheer quality of the writing. I mentioned I was a journalist at the time, and this Hamlet was only on there for 3 weeks maximum, and I saw parts of it 5 or 6 times, because I used to play truant from some evening job and rush back to catch what was left of O'Toole's Hamlet that evening. It was just the sense of there being now a breakdown of the division between high art and theatrical force, the division between what it was that you were supposed to study in school and the thing which was really happening to you as you sat in a theater.
Mark Norman, as you said, most people's picture of Shakespeare is that bust of Shakespeare.
That's right.
And, the long white hair or powdered wig, whichever it is, and he's an older man the way we see him in that pose. And, of course, in Shakespeare in Love, there's a cute actor playing Shakespeare. Right. And did you specify in your script, you know, young, cute actor?
No, but obviously he was going to be a young man in love, which is essentially a comic part. I mean, that's a traditionally comic role, the young guy who's has a messed up love life. One of the things the picture has done has... it's been established Shakespeare's a very sexy guy, which was a part of the plan.
Well, congratulations to you both on the success of your movie, and I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mark Norman and Tom Stoppard wrote the screenplay Shakespeare in Love, which is nominated for an Academy Award, one of 13 nominations the film has received. Coming up, a jazz trio with an eccentric approach to rhythm. This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says every jazz fan loves the rhythmic quality known as swing, which pushes the music forward even at slow tempos. Swing is created through small variations where musicians place their accents a little ahead or behind the beat. Kevin says the trouble is folks don't always agree on what swings and what doesn't.
The late Thelonious Monk, one musician who redefined what we recognize as swinging rhythm. When Monk came along in the 1940s, few jazz fans thought he swung. Nowadays, most every fan knows he does, hearing how he took the tiny hesitations and surges of rhythm that create swing and magnified them, blew them up. When Monk played with a rhythm section, he'd use an overtly swinging bassist and drummer for contrast. But what if a bass player and drummer took the same liberties with time as the pianist? That would sound something like this trio from Boston. Dallas Kariorgas on piano, Nate McBride on bass, and Randy Peterson on drums. Their CD, Heart and Sack, is on the Leo Lab label. The trio's timekeeping is so loose, sometimes it sounds like each player hears a slightly different tempo in his head. But just when you've given them up for lost, they all land in one place and head in one direction. For a little while, anyway. That tune is Miss Anne by Eric Dolphy, another musician who knew something about quirky timing. Now, there's nothing bad about this. Other musicians who played games with time and rhythm include greats like Earl Hines, blues man John Lee Hooker, and Bahamian guitarist Joseph Spence. What I like about Pandelis Kariorgas' trio is their brand of quirky timing walks a tightrope between swinging and not swinging, although to some jazz fans, it'll sound like they're not even in the tent. Listening to them can be like watching the tightrope wobble, thrilling because it's dangerous as they flirt with disaster. Better to make music that plays for high stakes than to just play it sure and safe.
Kevin Whitehead is the author of New Dutch Swing. He reviewed Heart and Sack by the Pandelis Kariorgas Trio on the label Leo Lab. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
For tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air, call 877-21-FRESH. That's 877-213-7374. Fresh Air is also available online at audible.com/freshair.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Bantam Books, publisher of Daniel Goleman's companion volumes, Emotional Intelligence and Working with Emotional Intelligence, available nationwide. And from Turner Classic Movies, presenting 31 Days of Oscar during the month of March. Tonight, James Cagney stars in Angels with Dirty Faces. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We're listening to the Tuvan throat singer Ondar. On the next Fresh Air, Ondar demonstrates the different styles of Tuvan throat singing. Also, we meet classical pianist Andrew Rangel. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air. TV. That was the wrong way to put it. Okay. In 3, 2, 1. I'm Terry Gross, the host of 91FM's Fresh Air. Tomorrow, a demonstration of Tuvan throat singing, and we speak with classical pianist Andrew Rangel. That's Fresh Air tomorrow at 3 with a rebroadcast at 7 on 91FM WHYY.